This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C, and welcome to the Breakfast Grill. When I finished my higher education certificate, I was one of the lucky few who were able to go overseas to pursue my education. But unfortunately, many of my friends were not able to as a result of the Asian financial crisis then in the 1990s. On today's Breakfast Grill, to help us answer the question on whether we have learned much from the financial crisis of the late 1990s, is Russell Napier. He's a financial historian and author of much celebrated books such as The Anatomy of the Bear and The Asian Financial Crisis 1995-1998. A very good morning to you, Russell. You know, go down memory lane. I think about close to more than 20 years ago, you were at Hong Kong. You joined CLSA in 1995, just 2 years before the Asian financial crisis then. You then predicted and forecasted the crisis to take place. I'm sure it wasn't a popular decision. How did you feel at the time when you were trying to forecast and predict this?
It was not a popular opinion. And unsurprised, I think, is the answer, because I thought that finance was a game of the rational, the reasoned analysis, and therefore people would be open to different opinions. But when you're in the middle of a boom of that magnitude, and it was a boom of a huge magnitude from Korea to Indonesia to India, it was really over a very broad space and in a very great way, then there is not a lot of reason around, and reasoned argument is put aside for the simple argument, look, it's going up, don't argue with it, it's going up. So to walk into a room where there's a great party underway and suggest that the party will end makes you unpopular. But I thought the interesting thing for me was that's what I kind of expected. But I didn't expect reasoned argument to be dismissed with, don't worry, it's going up. And Philip, that's a fairly common trait in any great bull market. And I think we've recently seen it in the crypto market, very similar. You know, reason was not acceptable as a form of analysis. And that's what happens. And that's what happened to me in 1995. Also, if you happen to be working in the investment banking business, there's lots of people creating new pieces of paper and selling them and making a lot of money. So the idea that you would tell people not to buy those new pieces of paper is bad for business. So it's not a good position to be in.
So rationality was cast aside. You even mentioned in your book that there was really a disdain for fundamental principles of business. And at the time, you kind of passed out that the problem you have is that in a growth economy, that masks and disguises all these fundamentals that are critical to define whether a business is good. So at that time, it was the financial institutions that really much, I think, were masked by that. In this age, are you trying to draw analogies that what we're seeing is that the tech sector and also the crypto markets also lack the fundamentals that we saw then?
Sure. As usual, Warren Buffett puts it much better than just about everybody else. And he said, well, it's only when the tide goes out that you realize who's swimming naked. And that is the way it works. And we have had a huge incoming tide for a very long period of time. And that means, what is the right question you should ask to see who's swimming naked? The answer is the balance sheet. Now, in a bull market, when asset prices are going up, nobody cares too much about the condition of the balance sheet, because on the whole, the asset prices will be going up, the asset side of the balance sheet. But the value of the liability stays the same, roughly. It may even come down if interest rates come down.
Yep.
So in this world, nobody asks the question, is this a sound balance sheet? Now, as the tide comes out and asset prices go down, that is when people, and what happened in Asia, they turned around and they looked at the balance sheets for the almost for the first time, because before that it was about growth, and growth is in the profit and loss account. And then they said, well, wait a minute, this company has got far, far too much debt. And that was the problem with Asia. It was the levels of debt. It had built an unsustainable system with too much debt. And if we look across the world today, we see many, many places where debt to GDP levels are also excessively high. So yes, it's a classic. It's not just the Asian financial crisis. It's the classic problem. A nice little quote from a man called Walter Badgett of the 19th century, who said, when the tide is coming in, you get mendacious audacity, which is, I don't know whether they sort of common English for that would be, but, you know, very flagrant lying. Well, if you want to get to the bottom of flagrant lying, look at the balance sheet. And that's what I suggest people do today.
Let's deep dive on the balance sheet, because the subtitle of your book, Asian Financial Crisis 1995-1998, was the birth of the age of debt. And if we reflect back on what happened in the Asian financial crisis, the issue was that the debt was in the wrong currency and in the wrong tenure, all short. That was the fundamental issue with the debt situation then, isn't it? Are there any parallels with today?
So that's 100% correct. And I'll just dwell on that a little bit, because it changes the very nature of the crisis. Many people listening to this will have lived through the 2007-2009 crisis in America, and you saw the Americans' response to that. Cut interest rates, print money. But Americans had borrowed in dollars, and that is the response if you borrow in dollars. You make those dollars cheaper to borrow, and you try to save the system. Now, the problem for the Asians in this period is they borrowed in somebody else's currency. Now, if you respond the way the Americans responded in 2007-2009, which is cut interest rates and print money, your exchange rate goes down, and your debt situation actually gets worse. So your companies that are deriving all their profits in ringgit and trying to pay back their dollar debt are in an even worse situation. So this was really a very unique and different situation, borrowing in a foreign currency. And one has to say that Asia generally has learned that lesson and learned it very hard, and foreign currency debt levels have gone up again, but they are, generally speaking, not at a level that would be anything like as bad as the Asian financial crisis. I have in the past years pointed out a few countries where it is true, and Turkey was the obvious one to me, and Turkey now is in a crisis. There are, we'd probably call them frontier markets more than emerging markets, in Africa and other places that have borrowed far too much foreign currency and are now likely to default. But when I look at the, if you call them the bigger emerging markets, if you like, that people listening to this may hold in their emerging market equity fund, I don't see too much foreign currency debt there, which may well be a legacy of the Asian financial crisis that spread to India, got to other places. And certainly China does not have excessive levels of foreign currency debt. We're all very familiar with the headlines about all of that foreign currency debt in the property sector. But in aggregate for the whole economy, it's not a huge amount of money relative. So I think there's a few isolated places. But in terms of, we're just focusing on what most of your listeners may be investing in, the broad emerging market equity index, I don't think we have repeated that particular problem. Now, there are lots of other parallels with where we are today. But I think the foreign currency debt one is really more restricted to what we might call more frontier markets.
So let's just go back to history then, because at that time, when you were in the midst of this work, a lot of the emerging markets were high in foreign currency debt. And you're now contrasting that with, in this current situation, it's a subset of the emerging markets, the frontier markets. That's why we're seeing the likes of Sri Lanka and Nepal, but not really the larger emerging markets really suffer there. When you go back to the work when you were there in 1995, 1996, besides, key metrics like debt to GDP as a ratio, what other key metrics were giving you warning signs and triggers that, oh no, we are heading into a massive crisis?
Yeah, so that is a very good question, because obviously debt can go up and up, and the naysayers will say this is too much debt. But what is too much debt? How on earth do you work out what too much debt is? And on the timing of that, it's very tricky. So I pointed to two things that said to me at the time that this was unsustainable. And the most important one was the condition of the external accounts. The countries were having, ultimately, to pay back foreign currency debt, you have to earn foreign currency. Now, in the very long run, you're going to probably have to run a current account surplus to be earning more foreign currency than you need to be able to pay it back. Now, by the time we get to the mid-1990s, not the early 1990s, a lot of Asia is running very, very large current account deficits. And they're also managing the exchange rate. So the only way that's compatible with a growing economy is huge capital inflow. And of course, it could continue forever, but the nature has a way of nothing grows to the sky. And so it was very vulnerable. It wasn't vulnerable to an exodus of capital. It was vulnerable to just stopping coming, because you ran these huge current account deficits. So there was a vulnerability there. And now what we couldn't forecast is when the capital would stop coming. That's incredibly difficult to do. But the vulnerability to a sudden stop in the flow of capital and the inability to pay back foreign currency, it was obvious from 94, 95, 96, but didn't happen until 1997. Post the Asian financial crisis, lessons were learned. The BIS, Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, has created an indicator which gives you a pretty good steer on when these things are coming home to roost. And then as you look at the ratio, the growth of the ratio of debt to GDP, and when it's growing faster than trend, that has historically given you a warning sign that too much debt may indeed be too much debt. So for those today looking for these indicators that things are about to, chickens are about to come home to roost, those are the two things I would point to. And you will find work by this, by the BIS on their website, on their early warning indicators. And I think they are the best objective measurements we have.
And that's why I always wonder why the crisis was so specific to Asia. Why did the contagion spread across Asia and didn't become a global crisis, right? It was very much confined to Asia, or it felt very much linked to Asia. Perhaps it's because of the liquidity of the capital inflows and outflows, right? That made it more vulnerable. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is fair. In some ways, it's the first crisis of the 21st century, because we had crises like this before, but they were driven by bankers. Bankers who lent dollars to, let's say, Mexico in 1982 and then stopped lending to 1982. And that was done by bankers making loans. But this one, particularly the Southeast Asian one, was nothing nothing to do with bankers. It was primarily to do with people buying equities and then suddenly trying to sell equities. And that huge, George Soros calls it the wrecking ball of global capitalism that swings back and forward, and the inability to cope with that very rapid movement of capital. Of course, in North Asia, in Korea and Taiwan, which also find themselves involved in this, it was more about the traditional bankers trying to get their capital out of it. So absolutely, it was definitely to do with the amount of capital which had surged in, and there was nowhere else in emerging markets like Asia. They hadn't been getting that capital flowing in that pace. But more importantly, short-term capital. You know, this Asian economic boom started with foreign direct investment, which comes in and kind of stays in and sticks in. And as it developed, shorter term capital came in. And the problem is it could also look for the reason to come out. Just one point, though, it did have implications beyond America. So Russia defaulted in the summer of 1998 on its debt. And I think there was a connection there. Brazil also had to devalue its currency. I think it was late 1998 or 1999. There was turmoil in this created some turmoil in Europe, which bankrupted a hedge fund called the LTCM, or a hedge fund that had to be bailed out. So it was rippling. It is interesting now to say it was just an Asian thing. But at the time, these ripples that we saw on the front line going out into the world, we really thought they could bring down the global financial system. And I have in the book a quotation from the IMF conference in October 1998, in which senior members of the sort of global establishment, finance ministers, central bankers, also thought this could bring down the entire global economy. So it didn't, but it was actually a fairly close run thing.
I wanted to build on this point, because back home in Malaysia, we experienced capital controls, right? By the end of 1998, you know, Malaysia imposed capital controls. You know, they didn't have any long-term repercussions to the country, because I'm sure they did it with the intention to try and avoid this exodus of liquidity out from the market, but I'm sure it had some long-term structural implications.
Yeah, well, you'll know in the book that at the time I was forecasting that Malaysia would impose capital, and then it happened. And that was a fascinating day to be in the stock market, because obviously I'm dealing mainly with foreign investors. I'm not really dealing with very many Malaysian investors. And they were still shocked, because this was changing the rules. And the instant reaction was, we'll never invest in Malaysia ever again. I think it was about 3 years later that they started investing in Malaysia again.
Memories are short then.
It does say that when money is involved, memories can be very short. But the reason that I forecast that Malaysia would be the country to do this was because of the very nature of what began as the new economic policy. It had a different name by the mid-1990s. But the administration of Malaysia, as every listener to this knows, is keen on the redistribution of wealth within society. And I thought it was going to be very difficult for them to achieve that if they got into bed with the IMF. So it was always, to me, virtually impossible. And obviously, the Prime Minister at the time was completely against the IMF. But I think the reason was that new economic policy was his brainchild, was his policy. So I think that's why it was inevitable that Malaysia got there and played upon, or not deliberately played upon. But I think the interesting thing was not that Malaysia did it. It was that investors had such short memories that a few years later, they were back, but never again in the scale that Malaysia received capital. I mean, but that's because it was just obscene, the amount of capital that was pouring into Malaysia. You know, it is still a small country. It was a small country then, but it was getting, in my assessment in this book,
disproportionate.
Probably a quarter of all the capital, liquid portfolio capital flowing to Asia, was going to Malaysia. Now, you know, as much as I love Malaysia, I think that's just a little bit too much. So that will never happen again. So it really blew the top off Malaysia, because it was just too much. So nobody complained when it was coming in, obviously, because it was such a great party. But there were reasons to complain when it started going up.
Well, thank you for being that party pooper. On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Russell Napier, financial historian, author of Asian Financial Crisis 1995 to 1998. After the break, lessons learned from the crisis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Russell Napier, financial historian, author of much celebrated books such as Anatomy of the Bear and The Asian Financial Crisis 1995 to 1998, as he helps us unpack how the Asian financial crisis in the 1990s unfolded. You know, Russell, when we reflect back on the past, the world did pull through, isn't it? So what lessons did we actually learn from the crisis?
Yeah, so I think the main lessons were learned in Asia itself, actually. And that was that, and this is a very big lesson, it wasn't really even about economics or finance. It was about, if you find yourself in this situation and if you have to go to the IMF, the IMF are going to impose some pretty tough conditions. And those conditions don't just relate to what we might call economics and finance. I mean, when they got to Indonesia, which was in much greater distress than Malaysia, they started imposing conditions about breaking up monopolies. And effectively, the Suharto regime was toppled by the IMF, backed by the United States Treasury. So this was an issue of sovereignty and independence, whatever one thinks of the Suharto regime. And of course, the Prime Prime Minister of Malaysia in particular was very clear that Malaysia should retain its sovereignty through this. So I think the lesson that the Asian governments learned is we need bigger foreign exchange reserves. We need a bigger buffer. We need a bigger protection. And I think and that has happened. And we had a generation, and you know, I mentioned in the book just how much these reserves rose and the distortionary effects they had in America and elsewhere. But I think for the people of Asia, and it'd be interesting to say what you think, Philip, about your friends and colleagues at the time, it meant less gearing going forward. It meant more, I mean, I'm not saying that it meant no gearing, but it meant more reasonable levels of gearing in the private sector. For the public sector of Asia, it meant much larger foreign exchange reserves. And, you know, growth returned. At the time, of course, everybody thought growth would never return. But under these policies, growth returned, and it was a more reasonable form of growth. I think balance sheets, as we discussed at the beginning, are in much better condition. So that's what Asia learned from all of this. Sadly, I don't think the West learned very much at all from this. I think we were standing on the abyss in 1998. You know, people were incredibly worried that this would be a global thing. We got away with it. We got away with it partially because the global central bankers cut interest rates.
Yeah.
And then the political time frame of developed world Western leaders is so short that they just kind of sighed a great sigh of relief and accepted what looked like all the positives coming to them from this. So I posit in the book that the posits they got were, you know, the positives they got were really cheap products coming out of Asia because Asian currencies had devalued, not just China, but obviously China played a crucial role. So they got really cheaper prices coming out, and they got very low interest rates because this reserve accumulation by the Asian central bankers forced them to buy lots of US treasuries. And they were so relieved that they were getting these positives out of this new system that they really were not proactive at all. And of course, the final problem was that the central bankers, who are independent of politics, had been given a target to keep inflation at 2%. They usually use the phrase to keep it at or below 2%, but that the natural forces coming out of Asia may have forced it way below 2%, but they kept cutting rates, trying to make sure that it would go up to 2%.
We're not even talking about 2% now, right, Russell? We're talking about 9%+ in the United States.
That's not where we are today, but for nearly 20 years after the Asian financial crisis, they had to try really, really, really hard to generate inflation even at 2%. And a lot of those low interest rates and excess money they created went straight into the asset markets, enfranchised people to borrow more. So the West actually, I think, in the West post-Asian financial crisis, but its policy settings completely and utterly wrong. And the Asians probably got it right, because I think they've built, you know, we should have had an agreement here as to how this was going to work. There was no agreement.
Yeah.
And Asia built more sound balance sheets, a more stable system. But the West, I'm afraid, the corollary of that was the West moved to a much more unstable.
Especially from what we've seen in the pandemic, I think Asian economies have been a bit more conservative or a bit more careful with how they dispense or even accumulated debt, right, to support the society during pandemic, whereas the West, I think, were very much driven by a lot more stimulus checks and such. Do you think that the pandemic has made the situation even much worse, that there's a bigger divergence between what's happening in Asia and in the West?
Yes, and it was obvious during the Asian financial crisis, because we've got to remember that the scale of this collapse in GDP and the consequences for the people of Asia were dire, and that for Indonesia in particular, one thinks, where there were riots, many people died, there was, you know, people close to starvation. Now, if I'd been living in a Western country that went through that, I would have forecast with a high degree of confidence that the consequence would have been more government spending, more government intervention, more safety nets, more demand by the people for social intervention. And yet we came out of the Asian crisis with really none of it. Mm. I mean, there wasn't a great change in this balance between the state and the private sector after the Asian financial crisis. And I think it's nice to compare that, as you do, to the pandemic. And look at what we're demanding in the West. Our levels of intervention were already much, much higher than Asia. What people demand from the state in terms of protection was much higher than Asia. Going into COVID, it's now higher. But Asia, and it's a great, obviously, as people can tell from my accent, I'm not Asian, but it's a great surprise to someone brought up in the country that I'm brought up in, that Asians don't demand this when things go wrong. That there's something in the Asian culture where, I'm not saying there aren't some people who demand, of course there are, but that on the whole, you don't have a great popular uprising saying we need more protection from the state. It doesn't happen in Asia, the Asia that I know anyway, to any great extent the way it does here. So I think you've raised a really important point there, that this divergence is now accelerated with COVID, and that is the world that we're living in. So you can tell from that, that, and as a long-term investor, it makes me a lot more positive about Asia than most people are here. I can see a divergence, a strong divergence coming, and that is a divergence which is positive for savers. It may not be positive for people necessarily, but for savers it's more positive to be in that type society.
In the situation we're in now, where it is a much higher inflation and inflationary environment, forget this whole idea of transitory, as you have dispelled that very fast. You talk about higher interest rates being talked about to a certain extent. Are you expecting to see certain parts of the world having a deep and painful long recession, while some will have a short and sharp recession like those in Asia?
Yeah, not a deep and long recession at all. If one starts with a market analysis that market prices and interest rates will reflect inflation, etc., one would categorically say we're heading towards a deep recession because nominal interest rates would have to be above inflation. And given the levels of debt in the developed world, in the West, whatever we want to call it, this would create a very deep recession. But that cannot be allowed to happen and will not happen. And therefore, that means we're not using market analysis. We're looking at something else now. We're saying, what will the governments permit in terms of interest rates relative to inflation? And that's a fascinating subject because it means you're moving away from a market system. So that's the crucial thing here now. We're stepping away from a market system. So most analysts can't get that because they just think like the market will deliver. So let's get to a world where they don't allow interest rates to reflect the rate of inflation. You don't get a really strong, bad recession, certainly in nominal terms, but even in real terms. Now, it can be bad for corporate profits, but not necessarily bad for GDP growth. So the historical parallel is really the post-World War II period. Now, there are many differences, but there are some similarities. But the recessions post-World War II tended to be fairly mild, and they were accompanied by inflation. We didn't destroy inflation during these recessions. Inflation stayed higher and rebounded strongly after these slowdowns or economic slowdowns. So the 20th century has had some vicious economic cycles with falling prices, deflation, falling corporate profits and falling stock markets. But that was not what one would have expected from the 1945 to 1979 period, when the governments were very keen to make sure that interest rates couldn't reflect the rate of inflation. So that's it's a different type of recession, but it's not like 2007, 2009. It's not like the one that many people are expecting to happen, but that's because the governments just simply couldn't allow it to happen. The consequences, once again, I stress, for the developed world more than anywhere else, are so dire that instead we'll just change the very nature of the system. So we're living through this great structural shift, but I don't think Asia necessarily has to follow that. That is, once again, to your point, is there a divergence now in the way things go? And there is clearly a divergence in the way things go. And I think Asia can take a different path because its debt to GDP levels are lower. So, you know, as I said, there's much, much more to say on that subject. But this structural divergence between Asia and the rest of the world is accelerating. We might want to discuss China separately because I think it's in a different position. It does have very high debt to GDP levels, by the way. And we might want to discuss China separate from the rest of Asia. But for Asia ex-China anyway, I think we get a very different outcome.
I would love to have a separate conversation with you on China, but we, you know, for our listeners, you're very keen on what are the implications to Malaysia. We see our public debt to GDP rise, household debt also rising. So we are actually on our side quite worried about the situation in our country. But you being able to see from an outside-in view, doing a comparative matrix with the rest of the world, how does Malaysia stand? What are the challenges that we have to specifically contend with unique to Malaysia then?
Yeah, so debt to GDP, what is too much debt? I mean, we're back to this huge, huge question. And there's no simple answer to that. But if it's local currency debt, I would say that you should not be at all worried about an economy where total debt, that's the government, corporate sector, and the household sector, is much more than 200% of GDP. If you're around that level, history suggests that you're not heading for any great crisis, that your economy can grow and actually reduce that with fairly low inflation and relatively good real growth. The problem we have is America is at 290%, China's at 290%, France is at 370%, Japan is at 420%. So compared to this, Malaysia looks relatively good. Now, the only side issue for Malaysia is foreign currency debt. Malaysia does have more foreign currency debt than others, but remember, Malaysia is a major commodity producer. And it is perfectly reasonable. I mean, obviously, commodities are priced in dollars. People who sell commodities get dollar cash flows. It's perfectly reasonable for them to finance. And Petronas in particular, I don't know how much of the foreign currency debt in Malaysia is Petronas, but you know, a significant portion of it. So I'm not concerned that you have slightly higher levels of foreign currency debt. So I don't see the problems for Malaysia. Malaysia's main problems will be what comes from external. We are heading into a world of higher inflation. That creates problems. But Malaysia is a much richer country than it once was. The countries that are really imperiled by high inflation are countries with many poor people who can't afford to eat. Now, Malaysia may have been that country in the 1950s or the 1960s, but it's not that our country anymore. So that level of inflation, that as in Sri Lanka, compounded with other issues, can create huge social unrest. That's not something that's going to affect Malaysia. So the problem, I think, for Malaysia is the imported level of inflation, which is, you know, it's bad. It's not, I'm not saying it's good, but it's not as horrific as it's going to be for Sri Lanka or Egypt or countries like that. And then maybe, and the people might laugh at this, too much capital coming in. One of my views on Asia ex-China is that too much capital might be coming. And remember, behind all of this is something that we don't have time to talk about, which is called friendshoring. And friendshoring is basically, I mean, let's be honest about what friendshoring is. It's buying stuff from anybody except China. These are not my words. These are the words of Janet Yellen.
Yes.
Who's the Secretary of Treasury of the United States of America. And Malaysia should be a major beneficiary of this. So you can see
is.
That when I look at Malaysia, I don't see the big problems that other people see for Southeast Asia in particular. This could be a boom time for Southeast Asia, with the corollary that, of course, it will have to import inflation because global inflation will be higher.
And, you know, Russell, we think a lot about the crisis that took place about 25 years ago. Many lessons were learned. I think at least some Asian countries have learned those lessons. But as you rightly point out in this really too short of a conversation, that many also have not learned from the mistakes of the past. How do we make sure going forward that we take into account all these volatile events of the past and make sure that we avoid these mistakes going forward again?
Well, you're asking the right person, because I'm a missionary for this type of work. So obviously I've written two books on financial history and what we can learn from. I've for many years now run a course on financial history for investors. It's called The Practical History of Financial Markets. The exciting thing is we've created an online version of that last year, which you can find out as the Advanced Valuation in Financial Markets. Same course, different name, but it's available online, so you can take it from anywhere in the world. And finally, the one that remains a concept, but a concept that I find incredibly exciting, is that we might open a library of mistakes. That's a library, by the way, is a room full of books, just for the younger listeners. I think a library is lots of PDFs online. I mean, a room full of books in Singapore. So I'm working on that. I have to admit, not making much progress, but various people in Singapore want the help. And we will try and see if we can have a room full of books in Singapore, which people can visit and read and learn and something from the mistakes of the past to help them with the future.
This should be a massive library if it's based on a library of mistakes, no?
Well, we have three of them already. We have one in Edinburgh. We have one in Pune in India. And we have one in Lausanne in Switzerland. So yeah, that's the problem with the library of mistakes, is where do you stop?
Russell, on that note, we have to stop this conversation. Thank you for spending your time with us on The Breakfast Grill. Russell Napier, financial historian, author of much celebrated books such as Anatomy of the Bear and the Asian Financial Crisis, 1995 to 1998. I'm Philip C., BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.